So I'm going to be presenting a company called Covidien. Covidien is a firm that is positioned in the healthcare industry, specializes in the production of medical devices mostly. It's a large cap, it's a $25 billion market cap. This company develops and manufactures but also sells the multiple products for both clinical and outpatient home use. It's currently divided into three separate divisions, and it kind of tells you a little bit about the product mix. Medical devices is the main one, but is also involved in the production of pharmaceuticals and medical supplies. So looking at the revenue by segment, you see there's been some changes in the past couple of years in how the company is trying to target strategy. Obviously, the majority of its production is in medical devices, and that remains so. But recently, there's been a fusion of the pharmaceuticals and imaging solutions into pharmaceuticals, and then the medical supplies cover the retail products and medical supplies together. And as you can see, the medical supplies have somewhat increases the as the total proportion. Medical devices stayed pretty steady as a fraction of the total. Geographically, the firm is fairly diversified, and it's also rapidly expanding to regions outside of the United States. So you see a share of the total. The U.S. has actually decreased from 66 to 55%, even though the overall sales have grown in there. There's been a pretty rapid expansion in Europe and parts of Asia. On top of that, I mean, just kind of a general overview of the strategy. Covidien is a firm that was a spin-off from Tyco Healthcare, and it was their branch of medical devices. And the firm has underwent some pretty significant changes in the past couple of years. What's important is to kind of notice the main focus of the management and see where the value is in this firm. There's very strongly focused on growth. They're trying to position themselves in such a way that they will be divesting most of the resources from areas of low growth, such as radiopharmaceuticals, etc., and going into things that will be growing at much higher rates. According to general market consensus, it's mostly medical devices and some pharmaceuticals. They're a very innovative firm, and innovation is sort of at the top of the agenda very recently. It's a trend that hasn't really been there before. I mean, Covidien had a fairly strong position in generics, which is overall a growing market, but now there's a significant focus on branding some of the products that they have, and that's mostly through innovation, things like new novel delivery systems for certain drugs, etc. And that's quite important in terms of adding value to the firm. They're certainly trying to, as I mentioned, leverage their global structure, and that's, you can see that by the shift in their geographic distribution of revenues. And they're certainly trying to increase their presence outside of the United States, and that certainly makes sense, especially in the emerging markets, particularly for things like medical supplies and generics. There's been quite a focus on decreasing the costs at the firm, and they've been quite successful at that. You can see that the margins have been steadily improving. They've always been somewhat of a firm was always positioned somewhat at a disadvantage compared to their main competitors in terms of driving down the costs. So the fact that they're able to cost control right now, some of that is through outsourcing operations outside of the United States, etc. It obviously adds quite a value to the firm. And then lastly, significant a focus of the firm was also on acquisitions, and they've been able to complement their portfolio in such a way that that it really makes sense. So some of the products that they are acquiring are either complementary or can be sold together with the products that they have, or they can use their supply chain quite effectively with the new portfolio companies. So not only are they trying to enhance their in-house research, but they're also actively and aggressively going into the acquisitions area. If you look at the stock performance, it's one done quite nicely over over quite a period of time. If you look at here at the 12-month period, it's been a steady increase and obviously pretty high returns. Recently, there's been a plateau, and if you look at when that's really happening, I think most of it is really at the end. It's in this area. As you can probably tell, that somewhat coincides with some of the healthcare changes in the United States right now. In terms of the valuation, the graph isn't really going to this date, but it's actually quite applicable to its current situation. It's the average PEs 15.6. This is all trading, and the firm is currently also underneath the its trailing PE currently at 14.9, which is below pretty much all of its main competitors. Here you see, for example, Baxter at 15.4, Hospira at 17.7, and the established price target for this firm. Again, this is mostly used by the consensus on the sell side, but I will walk you through some of the assumptions that they incorporate into their models. Is currently $60. The firm is currently trading at about 50. Again, another valuation, just to give you an example of why this firm makes sense right now in terms of a buy, is EBITDA, as you can see again, below its average. Price to sales, again, for this firm, below the average. And if you look at the earnings model, this is one of them that I think is very good. It's a fairly conservative one. And this is the one that really divides up the firm into medical devices, pharmaceuticals, and medical supplies, and looks at each one of these segments separately. And if you look at the general growth rate that is assumed for these, you can definitely tell that medical devices are on top. The growth rate there is expected between 7 and 10%. Pharmaceuticals are going to probably underperform and somewhat. I mean, it's a negative 2 to 1% range. Some of that is related to some of the legal issues around one of their main opioid lines that has been withdrawn. So clearly, there's going to be a sales drop. And then lastly, medical supplies, a fairly good stable growth of 2 to 5%. I mean, Covidien is positioned in such a way that probably their main medical supply segment shouldn't be much affected by any. Cost cutting in the hospital setting, which could affect medical devices, but clearly they're expecting pretty robust growth. Lastly, just let's talk about risks and maybe a little bit of my own point of view on why this company hasn't really performed that well in the past months since it was acquired by us. Clearly there are some things that are long term and no doubt will have an impact on the outlook here. I mean, hospital capital expenditures are the main one. And there's been a lot of the debate whether the hospitals in the U.S. and in Europe will pick up, their purchase volumes and et cetera, especially with medical devices. That's kind of an issue. The good thing about Covidien is that even though that's a risk, the kinds of things that they're selling are fairly... high turnover products. I mean, most of it is laparoscopy devices, things that are used and need to be changed every once in a while. And some of the devices are, because of the fact that they're quite innovative, could be incorporated into the system regardless of what the main capital expenditures tendencies are going to be. The U.S. healthcare reform uncertainty certainly added a lot of the discount into the stock price here, and clearly it's not really certain how much taxation is going to be placed on some of these firms, especially in medical devices and pharmaceutical segments. So that still is a question of what the margins will be for this firm. Foreign exchange exposure, while the firm is obviously globally diversified, it also adds quite a significant risk to its operational margins. And then lastly, in some of its segments, and mostly pharmaceuticals, well, you see the sales decline. There's been a commoditization and clearly a price pressure on some of the things like contrast material and etc., which they've been quite strongly present. So all of that together will create some of the risks for the firm, but obviously a good overall outlook. So, which is why I recommended them in the beginning.
All right, so I'll be, very original. I'll present Research in Motion. So, of course, a really old company, although I truly believe that in view of our macroeconomic strategy, and it really is one of those like Canadian technology companies that really could add value in our portfolio. So I'll go through my stuff quickly. Okay, so Research in Motion, I think most of you know the company pretty well. Developed the BlackBerry. Most of us actually own a BlackBerry in this class. This is a quick snapshot of the last 2 years of trading of Research in Motion. This is the American stock. Currently trades at 75.54. Its 52-week range is between 38.77 and 88.08. Its current P/E ratios are up 18, it has a bid of 1.03, and a dividend yield. It has no dividend yield, actually. It does not issue dividend. It reinvested in its growth. Oh, yeah, it's true. I'm sorry. Thank you. In terms of its the investment rationale, it will have a new updated browser. I'm actually presenting this to show you, like, how it will differentiate itself and get better in the next few years. So it has acquired Torch Mobile in 2009, which will actually bring an iPhone-like mobile browsing expertise. Also, it will release its new user interface in the next coming year. In terms of the application, which has become one of the most important things in the smartphone market right now, it's actually getting a momentum index in the last few months. Just to give you an example in terms of games, EA Games will actually develop a new game on the BlackBerry really soon. Right now it has 4,500 apps, although it will have more apps in the next coming years, and they've actually have struck a few deals with different developers. So this is actually really, really good in terms of that kind of stuff. One of the great things with Research in Motion, especially with the BlackBerry, it's really good as an entry-level smartphone. For example, its average handset actually sells at 320, while the Apple iPhones is at least 600, and the Google Nexus One, which is its new smartphone platform, goes at 530. Its cheapest one is actually at 250. So for someone that actually decides to go actually buy a smartphone, it usually is one of the best alternatives in terms of price right there. right now, the corporate IT departments are in a device refreshment cycle, while most of the average enterprise device that is 2 years old, they're not ready to actually change it. And BlackBerry is actually the best one for those departments, since it has the best security levels, and it actually gained many awards and that kind of stuff. So most of the IT department will always get the BlackBerry, and now they're ready to actually change it. So most of the there's actually a consensus among analysts on this subject that they will actually gain get like refreshment in that sense. Also, it is expected to launch 16 new models this in 2010, while only 5 were launched in 2009. So this is always also good. Just quickly, I'm just showing you the models that will actually be come out this year. So Tour 2, new 3G, just quickly. A new Storm, which is a slider, which is actually pretty cool. Now, they're going on growing international. I'll show you after the other sales are actually distributed. So now, while the UK and Canada and the US actually has a high penetration level, they're now going. They're actually going in the developing countries. I'll show you a slide after, which has a lot of potential, and especially China, India, Indonesia, as well as Mexico and Brazil. So right now, it's main revenue coming from the United States, 8% Canada, 6% UK, and 23% from other countries. And they are planning on increasing this share. This is a pretty interesting slide, actually. It shows you the countries actually they are in and their BlackBerry growth. If you actually look at Brazil and Mexico, it had a 1,000% increase last year. So this is actually really good, and they're planning on investing a lot in those places, as well as China. I will add a slide for Friday on China. They have a massive strategy in terms of going with China, and they struck a deal with one of the wireless carrier. And especially China, they're not that interested in getting iPhones or Google stuff, so they actually really like BlackBerry in that sense. And as well, you know, if you look at Russia has been increasing as well, Japan as well. This is really interesting, lots of opportunities there. So I did a DCF valuation to get my price recommendation. Quite conservative compared to most of the other DCF valuation done on this company. Company has no debt, so I simply get like a cost of equity. So there's no cost of debt. This is my valuation simply. I'm using the consensus as the sales forecast, and then I'm building the model out of it. So I'm getting a fair value per share of $95. Now it's trading at $70.75, and the consensus is at 89 right now, while most of the lower are actually trading, are actually predicting 79.82. Middle is actually in that range, and the highest are 120 right now. Now, in terms of the risk with this investment, well, obviously, macroeconomic environment could deteriorate. The competitive situation could intensify with new entrants. There could actually be a delay in penetrating new geographic markets, as well as new products that could actually be late. The monthly service fees could decline more rapidly than expected. Subscriber growth could deteriorate. Key executives could leave the firm, and of course, litigation matters could pressure the stock. So for Friday, I'm also planning to add a comparative valuation as well, show you like a better picture of the kind of feel.
It's 08 to 09.
Yeah.
Maybe you should give a longer run growth average. In 08, the market is just so crappy for everyone.
Yeah.
That's probably the reason why all those increases are so big. Maybe
1,000% for you guys.
Yeah, maybe like a 5-year.
although don't forget that like Mexico has they had like such a small base, so now like every increase like is of course like really big, you know.
There's also a lot of information on the file.
There's other information? Yeah, okay.
You're not getting
All right, that's good.
So just staying on time.
Yeah. Right, John.
So the Laurentian Bank of Canada, we bought it already, but I didn't get the chance to present it to you guys, so here I am. An overview for those of you, of course, who are not familiar with the bank. It's a Quebec-based regional bank, pretty small, 3,600 employees, market cap of $1 billion. It operates 156 branches, 410 ATMs. Most recently, it installed about 70 ATMs in the Montreal metro network and the subway, gain more exposure, generates fees. Most of its fees are generated actually in the retail banking in that sector. About 40% of its actually that's the contribution to net income. So about 40% of it comes from retail banking. It's not quite diversified. There's a big bias towards personal financial services, as you could imagine. The most profitable, however, on a margin basis, is the commercial real estate financing. Capital market securities is pretty small, 7% of net income. It consists mostly of wealth management and limited capital market activities, some trading. Asset management is pretty small, almost insignificant, and most of the deals are done here in Quebec, very few in Ontario, almost nothing, actually nothing in the United States. Institutional ownership is about 24% in the company. Going forward, their corporate strategy, obviously, is to diversify their revenue sources in the next 5 years. That's a snapshot of the stock performance over the past 3 years. So as you can see right now, it's trading pretty much at its all-time high, and it has been a high that was sustained pretty much throughout 2007-2008. In terms of volatility, it was slightly less than its peers in the industry. Obviously, it's a smaller bank. Its beta is closer to 1, whereas the others are slightly above 1. This one's slightly below 1, whereas the others, such as the big Canadian banks, are slightly above. So we could imagine that the volatility is a bit lower. 2009 highlights, the revenues were about $1.18 billion, flat over 2008. credit loss provisions, of course, peaked in 2009. Most recently, they were at $16 million a quarter for the past three quarters, I would say. So that's a big sign that loan loss provisions are peaking and are stabilizing. Net income was about $100 million. Return of equity, pretty much the same, at about 11%. Salaries expense, surprisingly, were up. They actually hired people in 2009, mostly in the mortgage business as mortgage sales representatives here in Montreal. The key measures I wanted to take out of the first quarter in 2010 which was which came mostly as good news. ROE improved, the Tier 1 capital improved. It's still lagging its peers, where we would find it in the range of 12 to 13% with the big five Canadian banks. It's still lower, but it's quite a significant improvement from the 9% that was prevalent in 2008, if I'm not mistaken. Leverage is pretty much the same, just like the other banks, at 18.5 times. Loans to deposit ratio have been decreasing. Obviously, during the times of the crisis, less financing activity took place. The long-term debt to market cap is about 14%, quite solid. The book value per share is about $39.5, and the effective tax rate is 27%. Not sure if you care about that last item there, but thought it could be interesting. So the 2010 earnings came in at about $32 million versus an adjusted $27 million in the fourth quarter of 2009. I'm comparing it directly to the previous quarter and not to the year before, just to avoid, just like Bronwyn said earlier, in 2008, obviously, it's not representative of the underlying operations. I think the previous quarter was a better representative. I'd say adjusted year because there was about $10 million that were non-recurrent. They came in from discontinued operations related to a sale back 5 years ago of an asset management component within the bank. Net interest income improved, which is one of the major measures that we look at in banks. Basically, they made more money due to higher loan volume, mostly personal mortgages. Again, surprising. It shows the position of the bank here in Quebec and its command of the personal financial services market. The efficiency ratio improved as well. That's another ratio that is very significant to banks. It basically calculates the non-interest expenses to the total revenues. So the lower it is, the better it is. And it decreased quite significantly. It was in the 70% range and 72% in 2008. For my earnings, I went with relative valuation in that case. Obviously, it's a bank. DCF doesn't make too much of doesn't make sense. The earnings, the way I projected them, is quite conservatively. I only included a growth in interest income and interest expense in the fourth quarter of 2010. And that would be merited by a probable hike in interest rates that are coming up and the accumulated growth in loans and mortgages over the past two quarters. I don't think it will be significant in Q2 and Q3. That is why I included only in Q4. I think Q1 showed an important growth in these volumes because of the RSP season and because of the recent hiring of additional staff in that line of business. But I don't think it's merited to continue on the same rate of on the same growth rate in Q2 and Q3 compared to Q1, so I only lumped it up in Q4, and it was quite conservative as well. It was about a 1% increase. Anyhow, here's the EPS estimates. Let's give you a second to take a look at them. And I applied the PE ratio and the PB ratio to my trailing book value, to my trailing EPS, and going forward, end of this year and of next year. I applied a ratio that is at its lowest range of the historical average, which is the current PE ratio of 10.5 and the current PB ratio of 1.1. As you can see, it trades at a discount. Again, it's a small bank. It does not command the premium that Royal Bank does, for example. Conservatively speaking, I wanted to remain cautious and not go with the historical average, but go slightly below that. Recommendation based on valuation and earnings per prospects is a buy, obviously, and the target price is $50. The consensus out there, it's a sell-side consensus, obviously. It's 4.5, actually, for the EPS 2009. Mine falls in the higher range, which is about 4.8, I think, the highest estimate they have. But let's not forget that after the Q1 earnings, some of the analysts did not change their recommendation yet, but it's probably going to increase in the coming days. Potential risks, most importantly, I think regulation is the highest risk, especially if it requires higher capital and lower leverage limits, legislation limiting cards, the way you charge fees and interest on cards. Laurentian Bank is biased towards personal financial services, so I could imagine that this could be a significant risk. Acceleration credit losses instead of stabilization, that could be another risk. Sluggish economic recovery, obviously, in Quebec. And systematic correction in financial markets. One thing I forget to mention, that I actually accounted for a small dilution of about 4% starting Q3, just to take into consideration the possibility of raising some capital to improve their capital ratios if ever required. Any questions?
Yes. There might be some.
A house bubble
in Canada, and, because most of their revenue comes from mortgages and their growth in mortgages. Yeah.
Also, the
That's a very valid point, actually. Yeah, I will include it.
Also, if you can put NPL.
Okay.
I
wanted to put that, but the thing is that it's a $1 billion company, right? Whereas most of the Canadian peers are, you know, you're talking Royal Bank, you know, $60 billion. So, but yeah, I could include something, make it more visible.
The only other, you said it's changing.
Yes.
But it's a historical low. The multiples have been very substantial. Are you going to go there recently?
Yes, and not to mention that Laurentian, when I say historical low at, in terms of P ratio, it's not that difference from historical average. To its competitors, that all has been significant. You're talking about. If I'm not mistaken, 14, and whereas you're talking 11 for Laurentian Bank. So the discount with competitors has always been there. The average for Laurentian is 11.5 right now, it's trading at 10.5. So, yes, it is at a discount of its historical average, but it's not that huge.
But the discount is sort of average, not historical low.
Yes, it is historical average,
okay.
Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you. Was it too long?
No, I think you were pretty much on time.
Just yes.
Okay, so today I'm going to talk about this company called Corrections Corporation of America. It's the largest U.S. Private prison company with a market cap of $2.4 billion. Within the private prison business in the U.S., they have 46% market share, listed on the New York Stock Exchange, CXW. Basically, the way they compete is because of their ability competing with the government on price and quality, they were able to gain market share every year.
They have a wide geographic representation. They operate in many states across the U.S., and they own a majority of their facilities. So there's a portion of prisons or facilities that they own, and there's a portion that they manage on a contractual basis. And I think there's a lot of potential because it's an underserved market with only 8% of prisons in the U.S. Private. And the market potential market is about $65 billion. So if you look at the trading activity, they took a big dip during 2008 because of the crisis. And I think that, you know, it required quite a bit. But it's undervalued mainly because they took a discount because of the budgetary issues. But my view is that the budget issue should actually benefit this company because of the deficit that the different states across the U.S. have. There's actually pressure on privatizing most of the correction facilities, like or jail. Because the government doesn't have money to fund these facilities. If you look at the current investors or stockholders, majority or about I believe about 90% are institutional investors, and the top management owns about 5% of the shares. So there is some alignment of interest as well. All of it is free float. So if you look at the historical performance, they outperformed the S&P quite consistently. So I would say that the stock on a five, if you look at this past 5 year performance, it's been doing quite well. So this is its business model. About 70% of the facilities they own and manage, and about 30% is managed on a contractual basis. The facilities that they own, they earn a higher margin, which is why they own a higher, like a greater portion of the facilities themselves. They've been growing quite rapidly in the owned and managed facilities area. As you can see, across the U.S., they operate and have contracts with many states, federal agencies, as well as multiple local agencies. But it's only in the U.S. So my first argument is, of course, why it makes sense for the U.S. to move towards privatizing the correction facilities. There are several factors. First, if you look at the costs, the private facilities or the companies that manage these facilities, they are able to operate at a lower cost. If you look at the operational cost per bed, or the operational or the cost you build each bed, if you look at both ways, the privatizing is cheaper. In terms of crowding, if you look at the public correction facilities, a majority of them are actually operating above their capacity. For example, California, they're operating 170% of their capacity. And by average, they operate about 130% of the capacity. Whereas the private correction facilities, they actually have a lot of available beds in inventory, so they're actually able to fix this. And the reason why the overcrowding is a problem is because programs like rehabilitation programs, it's hard to execute these things when the correction facilities are too crowded, and obviously there's a lot of cost implications as well. If you look at the age of facilities, the private correction facilities are newer and they're cleaner as well. And time to build these facilities, you know, as the number of prisoners or inmates increase, there's a need for them to build new facilities to meet these demand. And in terms of the public facilities, it takes them about 5 to 8 hours, maybe 5 to 8 years to build this. While the private companies, they only take about 1.5 years. So it makes a lot of sense to privatize. It's kind of building on what I said earlier. What drives the growth of these companies is the inmate population, and for the past like 100 years, it's only been increasing. Frankly speaking, if you look at some past data, about 2/3 of the prisoners they get rearrested within 3 years. So this is quite good for companies that manage these facilities, as I said before, the federal prison system is operating 137%. So certain states like California is operating above capacity. So there is a need or untapped demand for facilities that can take on these new prisoners. And if you look at the private prison market, it's been increasing at a compounded annual growth of 17%, which is really great since 1990s. And right now, the private correction facilities are only 8% of the total prisons in the country. So there is a lot of a potential in the growth of this market. This is an example of the California, like a picture of the California prison. You see, this is what I mean by 170%. I just want to illustrate that. So there's an advantage of a private management as well. If you look at the escape rate of a public sector, It's much higher than a company like Corrections Capital, Corrections Corporation of America. They're able to manage these inmates a lot more efficiently, seen by these numbers. If you look at the deaths, based on statistics, you would be more safe in these private facilities as well. So there is a lot of sentence there. In terms of the penetration of the market, if you look from 2000 to 2007 or even 2008, 2009, it's been increasing very steadily. Right now, approximately 8.5 or 9% are private prisons. And if you look at the prisoners since 1991, it's been increasing steadily at a 20-year compounded annual growth of 5%, and this really shows that it's not really affected by the economic conditions. So the price changes in 2008, 2009, post Lehman crisis, it's not really justified because pretty much they charge per prisoner. And as these, as it's growing, as the population is growing, the company revenues and profits should grow with that as well. So, looking at the company itself, if you compare this company with its competitors, they have the highest capacity, they have the most controlled or available beds. And the reason why this is important is as the population of inmates increase, the ability of these companies to capture this growth really depends on their capacity. None of these companies come close to CCA right now. If you look at the... Pardon? Okay. So if you look at the profitability, the gross profit's been and the margin's been increasing very steadily every year. So this is of course favorable. If you compare with the competitors in terms of the operating margin, it's been consistently above its peer. Right now it's about 18% operating margin. cash flow, they've been increasing the cash flow on a per diluted share basis, and that's, of course, favorable from an investor point of view. They actually initiated some share buyback initiatives. So this is, of course, favorable from a cash flow perspective. In terms of the balance sheet, all of their debt is in fixed interest rate, which is good. So there's not too much too many concerns about the Fed raising rates right now. None of the debt matures until 2012, which is great. If you look at this is basically their comparables seen before. If you look at the PE ratio or the EV EBITDA, it's trading at a premium above its peer, but this is justified if you look at the profit margin and the size of the company itself. Valuation, so there's two ways I kind of looked at it, the multiple approach. If you look at the historical 4P of 19.9 and its 2010 EPS consensus estimate, you come up with about $25. DCF with various assumptions like 38% tax rate, 8% capitalization rate, which translate to a terminal multiple of 12, discount rate of 11%, adjusted beta 1.16 based on Bloomberg. You come up with about $30, and you blend these two approaches together. You come up with about $27 or $27.50. This pretty much elaborates on what I was saying before. And really, because of the overcrowding situation and the budget cuts, and this really creates pressure for the government to privatize this. And in terms of rehabilitation, it makes more sense to privatize these prisons. So it actually increases the quality of the facilities as well. So I think this is a great opportunity to buy a stable market leader provider of the essential service at an attractive price. Risk, there's of course competitive pressure. It's a bidding process to get these contracts about 3 to 5 years. But the government can, or the states can, actually terminate the contracts at any time. So this creates some risk. And this business model is also highly capital intensive and sensitive occupancy. The capex per new bed that they build is about $50,000 to $70,000, and they are not profitable, or the NPV is zero until they occupy about 85% of their facility. And right now, their S&P rates them with double B, and this. This creates a risk because it's sensitive to capital markets. If the markets don't do so well, they can be cut off from the markets quite easily because of their rating. And there's, of course, a lot of political forces. If the government can simply decide to keep the their prisons at with overcapacity and decide not to do nothing, so that creates a risk. And legislative changes. Some states are. Okay, sorry. Questions.
Hi, I'm Amir, and today I'm going to speak about our benchmark, MSCI World Index, and its return and risk characteristics. We will briefly review its description and its return we want to see if any investment style can explain the result of this index better. If any country has a more important effect on the index, and if any of industries can explain the result better or not. Moreover, we will discuss the risk and the relation between the risk of this index and volatility indexes, and briefly the VAR. MSCI World Index is a free float adjusted market cap weighted index that is designed to measure the equity market performance of developed markets. Two important points in this description: that it is market cap weighted and developed markets. So there is no exposure to China, Brazil, or India. First of all, we want to see if any investment style has can explain the result better or not. What I used here is a simple regression. I used the Russell indexes, Russell value, value small, Russell gross small, and Russell value large and gross large, and compare the betas and the correlations. You can see that the large value and large gross has a higher loading, but we want to see if really it's a, we can, could we say that we have to invest in the large companies or not? And the answer is no, but just to see what we can say here. If you compare the result of the small value and large value indexes comparing to the our benchmark, you can see that the loadings of the large value and large growth is more. But because of the index is a capital weighted, this result is only, you know, statistical error, and we cannot say that we have to invest in the large companies. Maybe we can say that it's better not to invest in very small companies because it increases our tracking error. The other point that I want to speak about is the portion of the countries in this index. We don't know exactly what is the portion of the, each of these 23 countries. But if you use the index of all of these countries and compare it to the benchmark, and again using the slope, you can see the United States, as we can, I think it's obvious, has a more impact, and the and countries like New Zealand or Japan or Hong Kong has a lower impact. But what is interesting is that the correlation between the markets like New Zealand here or Japan or Australia with the U.S. market is pretty low, so this result can be explained, but with the correlation with the U.S. here. It's actually a 10-year. Yeah, it's a 10-year. Yeah. Yeah. The correlation, yeah, with the U.S., yeah.
So you're saying with the U.S., not with the MSCI?
Yeah, yeah. The correlations in the, yeah, here is the U.S. And the other point is the high correlation between the U.S. and Canada. So if we want to really diversify, maybe diversifying between U.S. and Canada is not a good choice. And the other point is that, as we can explain, 72% of the changes of the index by the U.S., by the changes of the U.S., market, our focus on the U.S. companies is justifiable. The other thing is which industry. Before I present the result, I just want to mention three points: that this result, based on the historical data, is only a general guideline, and the strategist view is most important thing here. So it's not the final answer to the ways of the industries. It's just a general view, overview. What I use here, I use the 8 industry that which are covered by our analyst, and use the iShares ETFs, and I construct a portfolio with the weights that minimize our tracking error. And the constraint that I had is that the sum of the weights should be equal to 1. We have to invest all of our money anyway. And the result is that the industrials has a 40
in order to minimize our tracking error, we should invest 40% in industrials, 25% in healthcare, and so on. Yes, it's on your right hand. On the right-hand side table, I relax the constraint not to invest all of the money, and results are comparable. The important thing here is that industrial here and here has higher portion and energy, both of them. About the volatility indexes, as we discussed, I think, last week, I compared the correlation of the each of the volatility indexes, VIX and VXN, with the volatility of R index. The correlation is high between both VIX and VXN. I think they are comparable. If we can invest in either of them, we can hedge our positions. As you can see, the R square and the correlations are high. And the last point that I want to speak is the VAR of this index. As you can see, it's about 2.899% or 1.13. So potentially weak, the benchmark can lose around something around 11% amount. So it's better to consider that. So summary, I think we should avoid small companies, at least. Importance of the U.S. companies in the benchmark and in our portfolio, and industrial and energy sectors, and finally, we can use the volatility indexes to hedge the risk. Thank you very much.
I know that the VIX, the VXN, and the MSCI all have similar volatility indexes.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are much more relevant than, the thing that we wanted to know is how well does the VXX track the VIX, and how well does
Look at that.